The local government elections in focus
on 702 and Cape Talk.
15 minutes after 10 o'clock, David Letswalo is my guest, a Sankarist, an activist, and a law academic. David, thank you so much, my brother, for joining me. I really appreciate your time.
Hi, good evening, Aubrey, and I really appreciate this opportunity to engage with you and your listeners. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Indeed, so do I, David. And I think these conversations, just by way of context, are important to me for a number of reasons. Amongst many reasons is that we are placing the conversation, the thinking around leadership, commemoration, history at the center of how we interpret our present, and how we should interpret our present, at least from your point of view, based on this particular column that you've written. I argue that we as Africans, and more importantly South Africans, have a very strange relationship with our past and how to commemorate it. And you make some interesting comments here about, you know, the media and how on the 15th people run helter-skelter to do that tick box exercise. And I think I agree with you that people do that because, you know, we've got to do something. But there is no real connection with that. I'll add and say that the way that we look after our museums, I was making the example of the house in Brandfort where Mama Winnie Madikizela lived during the days of her exile, as it were, to Brandfort. And you look at the condition of that house, even though it was declared at some point a heritage site. If you look at the various museums that come to post-apartheid South Africa, or as a result of post-apartheid South Africa, and you look at their upkeep, their condition. I'm talking here about the one here in Pretoria, I forget the name of that, very close to the Afrikaner monument, the Voortrekker monument. It's not looked after. I went there with my family to go and see what's there. It was closed. There was nobody that was looking after it. So I think I want to engage with you on that score as to how is it that we seem not to know or how to commemorate and preserve the memory of our past, particularly as it pertains to leaders that are understood to have been luminaries, particularly in the fight against colonialism. Your thoughts about that, David?
Thank you very much, Aubrey. You have actually summarized it so well, you know, the real concern about how we relate to our history. And by the way, the freedom struggle has got history in it. So you cannot really talk about our struggle out of a historical context as such. Mm. So this brings us to the real issue being the lack of consciousness and how seriously we take ourselves and our being and our existence as black people, as Africans. So the lack of consciousness about ourselves is important. I keep saying that what we did to black consciousness as a people, in black people in South Africa particularly, is that we didn't give it a chance and we allowed other people to make us antagonize it and, belittle it, and we didn't take it far. So if we have a content and substance, you know, born out of consciousness, then there's no way in which you won't be able to look at our historical aspects and lyrics in the in context. So we have come to a point where we only see our history and anything related to our history in terms from a commercial eye, you know, the commercial point of view. So that is why, you know, even the commemoration of our heroes by the media is seen in terms of we need to, because there's a sensation and frenzy around Sankara now, so would be really out of place if we don't seem to be relevant. So we tick boxes from a commercial point of view, and maybe also the question of followership, readership, viewership, whichever point you are at. Another point is that we have a total lack of appreciation of ourselves. Where comes the issue of self-hate, lack of self-respect as a people, where you don't see anything of value in your being as an African. And also the question of sincerity, that even our leaders, when they look at the freedom struggle and our history, they're not sincere about it. They look at it as an opportunity to eat, for instance. And that's why you won't be surprised when you find people trying to make a big buck or, profit, surreptitious profit out of the funerals of, Nelson Mandela and Winnie Mandela, which are quite painful. That is why you see the example gave of the museum, the house in Brantford of Mama Winnie Dixon Mandela, not being taken to heart. We always looked at as a cash cow, if you like. So there's no commitment to that, which brings us to the fact that we look at our history and our struggle as a point of rhetoric. We just talk about it to be relevant, maybe in our rallies or wherever we are to show that we belong, we affiliate to the struggle. Whereas in our hearts, we don't mean it. In other words, we abuse our struggle and the reality of our struggle. So there's no context to all these things, and it's frustrating. And I can imagine the frustration that you've had, especially with your family visiting all these museums, and find that there's no care. We don't respect it.
Let me tell you the story very quickly. I had decided to take my family on a tour. I've told my listeners of the story, so many of them would be aware of it. Because I was quite frankly disappointed, not angry, but disappointed. I had decided to take my family on a tour of some of the museums in the area of Pretoria. I went to the Transvaal Museum, which is a natural history museum, to go and show them. I don't know if you know Pretoria very well, but there's what is known as the Transvaal Museum. It's a natural sort of history. We went there, and It's sadly dilapidated. It's not looked after, and I suppose those are issues that have to do with funding and so forth. I then drove on to go and see. I think it was Heritage Day about a year ago or so, and then I went to go and see the Voortrekker monument of the Afrikaner people. Ne? When I arrived there, there must have been about 15, 20 buses full to capacity with foreign tourists. Yeah? No, this was 2019 because last year was COVID-19 and these places were closed. There must have been 14 to 15 buses full to capacity with tourists from China, from Europe, from Argentina because I went to go and engage them. I went to go and speak to them, to go and ask them, where are you from? Why did you come to this particular museum? And this is what they said to me, all of them, that it is effectively marketed in our country. And the people, it's effectively marketed. So in other words, the Afrikaner community is not only marketing their history in South Africa, but also overseas, so that when people come, they come to see that part of South Africa's history. About 20 buses, maybe even more, full to capacity. Most of the people that were there were foreign people from other parts of the world. About 3-4 kilometers down the road, connected by a similar road, is the Freedom Park. I drove on that, and that was an interesting thing to see. Lots of people had come to visit Voortrekker Monument. I went to Freedom Park. My car was the only car that was there. It was closed. There was a security officer who said to me, man, I can organize you something. Give me something, and then I'll open up. You and your family can walk around. No, I'm telling you the absolute truth. And that was the general attitude. Things were new, and they looked nice and everything else, but it was closed, and you could see that maybe it was supposed to be open, but the person who was supposed to be there probably decided, I'm not going to. And so I echo the sentiments that you are talking about. But then I want to challenge you, David, and say to you that perhaps part of the reason why the doctrines and tenets of black consciousness are a little too elite to be absorbed by the masses, and that it is the playground of intellectuals such as yourself who speak about these wonderful things in pear-shaped tones. Thomas Sankara of Burkina Faso, who means nothing to me if I live in Mamelodi, Komshengu Vilu, Kodunosa, or whatever the case may be. But secondly, that this is nothing more than the intellectual acrobatics of those who are in high places of the rooms of academia, who speak about these things in English, who don't commemorate these things in languages that are relevant to us on the ground. And so while we wax lyrical and talk about the lack of consciousness of the people, couldn't it be perhaps placed at the door of the intellectuals, the David Letswalos, perhaps even some talk show hosts, that they talk about these things, but they keep it elite and they keep it away from the people. In fact, it means nothing to the people, and that's why people don't feel any connection to it. And that's why people that are in the media will engage with these things piecemeal, in a truncated manner, in a choreographed manner, in an unsoulful manner. David Letswalo?
First and foremost, you should have been angry. You should have gone beyond frustration when you saw that.
Why? Why? My children want pizza. Why must I be frustrated? I take them to a pizza place.
Okay, but my view is that you would have been justified to get into the realm of anger,
sure,
transcend, you know, beyond mere frustration to that kind of directness. You know, the thing is with Africans, you know, us, and me, is that our anger dissipates, and we are very much shy to be angry at injustice and at wrong things.
So, especially when it's committed by people who look like us.
I mean, like, yeah.
Because, David, I mean, I'm sorry, I will be jumping very quickly. The moment something is done by somebody who doesn't look like us, then Black Twitter goes crazy. Aubrey Masango, Clement Manyatela, and Bongani Bingwa go crazy on radio. David Letswalo writes a powerful column. Huh? Isn't it true, David?
You know, what you're saying has got a context to it.
Yes.
And actually, what you're saying, on the contrary, I think support what I'm saying, that we actually judge ourselves instead of being angry at injustice. And secondly, that our pain and suffering has, you know, invariably been meted out and orchestrated by people of other races. But that does not mean that our people do not make mistakes. Hence, I'm saying wrong is wrong. But mustn't decontextualize it to locate the source of our pain and suffering and oppression. Because wherever we are as black people, as Africans, we are basically oppressed on the basis of the fact that we are black or we are African. So coming back to your point about, you know, lack of regard for you know, these issues, and then you're saying they are actually in our space as intellectuals, or, you know, as the media, as people, media gurus like yourself. Look, I don't think so. If there's any ideology or way of life that was as simple, you know, and accessible to our people in this country over history, is black consciousness. Because the work of Steve Biko made it so simple, that made people to understand black consciousness in terms of the daily experiences. For instance, the issue of discouraging people from, you know, skin lightening, liking their own hair, liking their skin, liking who they are, self-respect and self-acknowledgement. So the issues such as, black is beautiful, and also the idea that because of black consciousness, we didn't have to come with fancy terms to explain it. It was just a practical thing that Biko advocated, and, you know, in terms of how to practicalize it. Work for yourself, be self-reliant, you know, care for your neighbor, or black solidarity. And that is why it was easy under black consciousness. Now, that is before the unbanning of the ANC and the PAC and so on, to actually take action, like, you know, in terms of your consumer boycott. It was not like mystical or highly intellectual. The struggle and the ideology was broken down into practical experience.
Let me challenge you again, David. My issue is definitely not with the content of the doctrines of black consciousness, pan-Africanism, and all of them. Absolutely not at all. My issue is not with the luminaries. It's not with Biko or Sankara. It's not with that. My issue is in the delivery of that content. The delivery of that content after the death of those particular individuals, whether you're talking about Biko, you're talking about Robert Sobukwe, you're talking about Sankara, is that it was delivered by people who had read many, many books, who delivered these ideas in English in ways that were highly cerebral, not connected with the daily lives of the people in that particular time. So what happens is that people would refer to the words of Thomas Sankara in the past tense, and then people would then shake their hands in deep nostalgia at what they've just read or just said. I argue and I challenge you, David Letswalo, to say, if a guy is living in a hostel in Mamelodi, yeah, and is worried about when his next meal is going to come from, they are not interested in the pontifications of Aubrey Masango and David Letswalo about Thomas Sankara and how noble his ideas were in as far as the black identity is concerned. And I'm suggesting to you that that is the failure of the idea of ideology such as black empowerment and pan-Africanism, that it has been eliticized, that it has not spoken to the daily bread issues of the person, Ojang Maotwana Lewiring Kokasi. So you can come here with issues of black essentialism and the issues that are raised by Thomas Sankara and Steve Biko in Frank Talk, whatever you want to do. I'm saying to you that it's not the content, it's the delivery of the content, the optics of the content that has alienated the people who are supposed to be the consumers of these ideas from those ideas.
Look, Aubrey, what you're saying for me is something that I would take as a, you know, lesson for whoever is an activist to always bear in mind when they reach out to our people. Mm-hmm. But in my experience, I think, you know, more especially, you know, in the post-2000s in South Africa, to be specific, we have had this shift where people made, moved away from, you know that those jargons of the dialectic materialism and
hetera, the polemics of what.
Yes, but I think that has been put in the shelf where it belongs. Yeah. And people are talking about removing the shelves, the land, all these issues that, you know, that need to be delivered for people to realize the true freedom. We must remember, Aubrey, that even in as early as 1993, 94, when the PAC was saying the land first, all shall follow, because of what you're actually saying around it, the intellectualization of our pain and our struggle. So that was like mocked by...
Let me be clear, David. Let me be clear, my brother. It's not the intellectualization thereof that I've got a problem with it. Because that would suggest that black people don't have intellectual capacity. No, that's not what I'm saying.
Sure.
Mine is to say it is the elitization of these issues, right? It's not the intellectualization of them, because people can deal, people can handle intellectuality. What the problem is, I submit, is making these ideas elite, inaccessible. The mainstay and the pap and flace of the clever. So it's not the intellectualization of the issues. And let me add and say that it is the deifying, it is the canonization of these luminaries without necessarily encouraging a situation where the people of that time, the people who live in that real time, are the expressors of their struggle and their solutions connected to the leadership of those luminaries.
Oh, sure, I agree with you. And whether we say intellectualization, I think if there's anything that is close to elitism, it starts with being intellectual, even where you're supposed to be pragmatic, you know, and practical as it were. So a good example is with Sankara. Sankara actually read a lot, when he was a military student, if you like, and studied the revolutions across the world. And hence he was actually saying, even if you're a soldier, you need to be, you know, well-read as such. But what did he do? He actually did what you are saying, to make all these theoretical issues ideological, you know, prescriptive. Very, very practical. He didn't have to tell them that, this is Marxism, this is Leninism. And he just did it and then encouraged people in that particular way. So in fact, what you are advocating is the embodiment and practicalization of what Sankara would have been. So I may not be wrong to say you could very well be a Sankarist, because you are actually that Thomas Sankara
All right, let's invite some of our listeners on 011-883-0702-021-446-0567. Madame says Sekhoa nake, English class is in session. Must read some books, man. What you talking about? Here's the thing. Please join us. The issue I'm grappling with David Letswalo, who's obviously a thinker about some of these issues, is how do we make real? How do we make real the humanization of African people? See? Fundamentally, that's what this is about. How do we make real? In other words, how do we stop performing it? How do we stop performing it and actually be it? Because I argue, and this is to you, the listeners of this show, that we love to perform. We love to have a heritage day where we wear dashikis and our afros, and we remember, as David was saying in his column, we remember, and media houses are falling all over themselves trying to authentically speak of these luminaries of the struggle of the African people. And he is correct, because it is, and it does feel choreographed and a tick box exercise. Absolutely agree with him. How do we make real the reality of being African? How do we speak of the realities of being African in this time? Not in Thomas Sankara's time, not in Biko's time, but in this time. How do we encourage luminaries of 2021 to emerge instead of sounding clever by being able to quote Thomas Sankara or Steve Biko? How do we, because Steve Biko and Thomas Sankara, as much as they too were learned people, as much as they were people who had read lots of books like David Letswalo, spoke of their realities. And that's what made them authentic. How do we get out of the performance of our politics? I was speaking to some politicians just now, David. I don't know if you were listening.
No.
Yeah, I was talking to some politicians just now, speaking to four politicians that are trying to become the boss of the city of Tshwane. All of them were performing. Well, if I don't do what I'm told to do in as far as hosting these people and asking them questions and hearing what they've got to say, I might lose my job. But I think it's the most useless exercise. Because all of them are going to promise something. All of them are going to try to sound clever and all of that. But none of that stuff is going to happen. My question to you is, how do we make real the aspirations that may or may not have been articulated by these luminaries, but live to this day in the hearts and minds of the people of this country? How do we make them real? How do we make them authentic without always wanting to perform?
We have attached so much value to elitism and certification and the notion of sounding too advanced or clever, that we feel that if we can communicate a message or do something for the people without sounding that way, maybe we're not proper leadership as much. That is why people are so full of quotations and so on. But I can dare, quote, some of these people in order to handle malignia to as it were. So, Malcolm X said that he would want to be remembered as someone who was sincere. Even if he made mistakes, those mistakes were made in sincerity.
Yeah.
But at the same time, Thomas Sankara says he would like to be remembered as someone whose life has been helpful to humanity. So what all this points to, they point to the type of leader that we need, a servant leader, because you cannot be a leader if you don't love your people, in the true sense. Because there's a difference between a leader saying, I love you, and then with him actually loving you.
Did Hitler love his people?
Excuse me?
Did Hitler love his people? You see, David, my brother, I worry, my brother. I get deeply concerned about certain throwaway statements that I hear even politicians to this day use. Without the proper contextualization thereof. I remember listening to the leader of the Barking this movement, Afrikaans Weerstand Beweging, AWB, Eugene Terreblanche.
Oh, were you his follower?
Yeah, no, I follow everybody.
Okay.
I remember listening to a speech on YouTube that he was making or speaking to a journalist. He said, I love my people. What is it? What are we talking when we are saying, I love my people? Leaders who love their people.
If I were to respond, you must be prepared to subjugate yourself completely, to their need, genuine need. And this points to an element of sincerity, honesty, uprightness, and basically love. So without all these elements that I have indicated, there's no way in which you can become a servant leader. If I were to ask all these people who want to be elected, now in this election, to say, if we were to say the councillors are not going to be paid, just serving people. I can tell you that less than a quarter of the existing, cohorts of candidates will disappear from the space. And also that whatever,
Especially the well-fed, plumpy ones, eh?
No, anyway, but the point I want to indicate is that there's no sincerity and integrity in this whole thing, the uprightness.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that the kind of luminaries that we refer to, be it Malcolm X, Obukwe, Biko, Sankara, there's a common thread in whatever they were talking about. I think you might even think that they were sitting in one class, crafting the struggle. Central to that is the uprightness of character. Because Sobukwe said that, Biko said that, and Sankara was embodied it in various ways. So that is
Definitely not this group. Our current leader, definitely. definitely none of them.
Look, I think it brings me back to the fact that I think black consciousness was interrupted. And my view is that we should take it straight to our spaces, be it in the classrooms, in wherever we are, the clubs and everything, make it more than fashionable and be a lived reality, as we could have said, that it becomes a way of life. I can tell you that if we had that, all these challenges that we are experiencing would be a thing of the past, because black consciousness would mean that we also have conscious citizens, men who would actually be not be fooled by T-shirts, for instance, small things like that. So we were for afraid, like, you know, at a particular time we come around, and because we don't have a foundation, we don't have the substance, we don't have the consciousness. So I think if we can turn that space around, I think we can solve that particular problem. So at the end of it, it's about servant leadership in the true sense, not rhetoric.
Yeah. So Sitwell Mqina is saying, "Obri ukate ulwimi lakho." Keep it simple. Basically saying, and I hear what he's saying, and what I've been doing very deliberately to prove my point. He says, "Obri ukate ulwimi lakho ndoda. Look it here and keep and come simple on air." Says this person. I could argue very, very easily to Sitwell and say, Sitwell, you must read. Eh? Sitwell, you must read. But that's the point I've been trying to make with some of these notions, these ideas, these ideologies, black consciousness, Pan-Africanism, socialism, whatever Zim you want to talk about, right? That it has been the playground of the elite. And I'm saying to you that part of the reason why you, for example, may feel that black consciousness didn't have a chance is, and I'm still interested why you're saying that it wasn't given a chance. I would argue that it was given a chance. The only problem is that those that saw themselves as the custodians of black consciousness wanted to keep it amongst themselves so that they can continue to sound clever, so that people like Sitwell can not know what we're talking about. So I'm saying that the problem is not necessarily with the content of black consciousness. It's not necessarily with what black consciousness was trying to achieve, because that was noble, it was humane, it was trying to make people understand humanity. But it was the fault of the intellectuals who keep this kind of information amongst themselves by eliticizing it. So I'm saying I challenge the idea that it wasn't given a chance. I think it was.
Let me say this to you. I don't know, you know, if ever you've had the opportunity to, you know, to interact with a black consciousness leader or veteran, you know, as such.
Yeah, just about a month ago, I was speaking to the former leader of the Azanian People's Organization, AZAPO. Yeah, he's just written a new book, and we were talking about the very same issue that you and I are talking about. Not too long ago, I was in contact with, I was on this particular show with Ntate Bani Pichan. On this very, very show, I was speaking. He said, so, no, we talked to these people, David.
Sure.
Yeah.
Now, once you mention those people,
yeah,
there's no way in which you can come to the conclusion that such leaders, including people like Ntate Tianemawa, would have complicated this. I told you earlier on that what was amazing about Black Consciousness Movement was its ability to move away from the intellectual to the practical. Hence the examples I gave about Black is beautiful and so on, about the hair and all that. But about interruption, I'm serious about this point, Aubrey, because there was a point in the history of this country where Black consciousness, people, or even Africanists, were harassed as the so-called
victim. Sure. Yeah.
You know, that was a painful story of Black on Black. In fact, because Black consciousness would have been a key to our total freedom, because it rested on the issue of unity, of Black solidarity. So it was interrupted. And with the advent of the Rainbow Nation, as it were, post-1994, Black consciousness and the Pan-Africanism, you know, suffered a bit because a strong current dominance of people would never actually embrace these things. So hence I'm saying it's so amazing that from 2000, you know, we have seen this resurgence of Black consciousness and Pan-Africanist ideas practically in the life of our people, where people actually look at practical things like your landlessness, your mikuku, hunger, and all these kind of things, and contextualize to the idea that this is what oppression is about. And I know you're checking you're following what the electioneering is about. You can actually see that Black communities are alive to the practicalities of the struggle, and was moved from those things of dialectic materialism and the sloganeering from wherever. So I'm very, very sure that there is a chance that the struggle is not being made abstract. It's experiences of the people.
So let me perhaps explain what I mean by the elitization of these ideas and these ideals. You're right that the individuals that I've spoken to that I consider Black consciousness disciples of our modern era are not complicated people. Yeah, so you're right. But I'm addressing the issue of the idea that Black consciousness was not, or was, how do you put it? Was not given a chance, was interrupted. That's what I'm looking for. I'm saying that those that did not, that had the mantle of Black consciousness did not use perhaps the communication instruments of the time to tell their story. Much like the whole story of vaccine. The discussion around vaccine is really amongst those that have read, that have been to a podcast, that have, and then it doesn't get to the people who are hesitant about the conversation. I mean, about vaccination, because it's spoken in terms that talk down to the people. Now, the professors that I speak to, the doctors that I speak to about vaccination, are sincere people who speak at the level of their understanding of these things. I'm arguing that the conversation about vaccination has remained very elite and hasn't used the communication apparatus and styles that are understood at the level of the people on the ground. And so one can argue and say, no, but these people are sincere. If you speak to Professor Malikapuru, I mean, he's very sincere. If you speak to Professor so-and-so, he's very sincere, he's very clear. But I'm challenging the idea that even their credentials, the platforms on which they speak, the tonality that they use may not be accessible to the people that need to hear it. And by the same token, the message of Black consciousness and Pan-Africanism has remained at that level. that it hasn't used the colloquialisms, it hasn't used the idiomatic expressions of the people at the time, in real time. And for that reason, I say, it was given a chance, but it remained elite.
Hombre, I think we must, close this point on the understanding that we may agree to disagree.
Okay.
Because I strongly believe that black consciousness was as simplified as possible. Remember the whole idea that black consciousness should be our way of life. That was not a slogan. It was about the message of delivery. That when the people interact with the leadership, black consciousness leadership, the idea should be that our people should embrace black consciousness, not as a theoretical kind of phenomenon, if
sure.
you like,
yeah.
but as their way of life. And the practical examples of how, without being told that the definition of black consciousness and all that, but to say these are examples of how you should practicalize, black consciousness, like your own community works, your own community programs, developmental aspects, cleaning the environment, buying black, embracing yourself. All this, you can't get, realistic and practical, pragmatic modern day.
Mm.
I insist that the dominant part of our black liberation movement that actually came out strong post 1994, which actually got was from the mid 80s became far much stronger, dislodged black consciousness from our community.
Yeah.
Hence the issue of killing them and harassing them in the as the Zimbabwean. And that's it's a reality, and you're not going to run away from it. So what we need to do, and I think I mentioned this earlier on, is to take your advice, your concern, to say going forward, the leadership, whichever is embracing black consciousness, should guard against making this way of life elitist. So another thing that we need to take care of, and I think it comes back to what you actually said about how we don't appreciate ourselves and our history, is that there came, with the transition, there came a strange culture in the country which was rooted in materialism and, self-centeredness, which is what we are battling with today, which has led us to this untamed corruption that we have today, to a point that we don't really believe that somebody who fought in the liberation struggle could actually steal something that is meant for the people. There is that kind of disjuncture. So I think we need to be very, very, very clear. And with you and I, we should actually play a role in terms of bringing these aspects together and bringing the consciousness aspect to our people, that black people need to find themselves as it was in the 70s and 80s.
If Sankara was alive and he was watching the local government elections campaign, what would he say now?
He would think. Actually, I think Sankara would be. I have this idea that he would immediately die. Everything that he has advocated. Sankara actually said, I have studied all the revolutions. The people of Burkina Faso did not manufacture the struggle. They became the beneficiaries of the experiences of other revolutions. So they were the heirs of other people's revolutions. So what did we do in South Africa or Albania after 1994? We pretended that nothing was ever done by other nations, not especially in Africa. So we decided to come with something completely new, whereas Sankara and others had given us a template. I like referring to the quotation by the president of Rwanda, who said after the revolution and he came to power, he realized that a brother, an African leader, Thomas Sankara, had done all the thinking and the planning. All he has to do as Kagame is simply to implement.
David Letswalo, let me stop you there, my brother. Let's stop it there because we've run out of time. Always great talking to you.
Thank you.
Much appreciated. A Sankarist, an activist, and a law academic. I really appreciate your time.